Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing an interview I did with Wade Russo, who is musical directing and conducting the production of Showboat, which is currently playing at the Oslo Repertory Theater Company in Sarasota, Florida. Listen to Wade talk not only about how his very circuitous path to where he currently makes his life as a musical director and conductor, but also listen to his encyclopedic knowledge of the show, Showboat. And not only of Showboat, but of so many other musicals based on important books. So hang on, here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from
show is about discovering who you really are so you can find your very best place in your world, so that you can be in the place that was perhaps made for you based on all of the things you are. As a psychotherapist, it is my belief and my experience that most of us are not in the place that was perfectly made for us based on all of the things we are, because unfortunately, many of us, maybe even most of us, have been forced to sacrifice pieces of ourselves in order to survive our childhood. That is, our childhood in our family of origin, or in our school, or in our culture, or even in our religion. And having sacrificed that, pretended we didn't have that, we forget that we actually had whatever it is that we had to give up, our sense of humor, our interest in a particular subject, our assertiveness, our frivolity, our talent. So that is what the show is about. That is what I talk about in every show. And in every show, I play an interview with someone who makes their living or their life with an art. And I do that because when you listen to someone who does that, you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are, because these people, at least in their work, are all that they are. Because in order to make a living, or even a life, because so few make a living, based on an art, It has to be who you really are. We make it so hard in this culture. So those people who do it because it is intrinsic to who they are. And when you listen to them, it is my hope that you will be inspired to ask yourself, is this how you feel about your life? Is there something you think you might have left along the way that you might be able to recover? This interview, the one I'm going to play today with Wade Russo, is very long, and so I'm not going to talk very long today so that I don't have to stop very much of his interview. And also, I'm playing an interview, which I am reading, but which was written by Sharon Leslie, my reviewer, of the production of Showboat. That will be at the end of the show. If you're curious about what I think about why we have to sacrifice parts of ourselves, you can find information about that and information about me and the way I do psychotherapy, which is all on the phone these days, at my website, thelynnshow.com. That's thelynnshow. Don't leave the E out of Lynn. I wrote an article about psychotherapy on the phone. That's up there. The title of my book and how you can get it is up there. And all the other interviews that I have ever done, podcasts of all my shows, are all up there. But I really don't want to say anything more. I want to introduce the really interesting, really articulate Wade Russo. So here he is. So I am here with Wade Russo in a conference room at the Oslo Repertory Theater Building, and I'm talking to Wade.
A temple of the arts.
A temple of the arts.
It is.
I'm talking to Wade because he is the musical director of the very first production of the Oslo Repertory Theater 2013-2014 season, Showboat.
Yes.
And I want to talk about Showboat for a number of reasons. I want to talk about this production, but I also know that you are the Showboat Maven. And I know.
What a moniker to be wearing, but someone's got to do it.
Yes, clearly, and you volunteered. Yeah. But before we do that, I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. Clearly, you make your life and your living with the art of music.
Yes. Very, very fortunate. It's quite a blessing in this strange business. And they don't call it show art. They call it show business.
So as a result of that,
to be able to have a career in the theater is, of any length, is always, a blessing.
Yeah.
Because
it's tough to pull off.
Yeah. And there's so many people that, the competition, everyone is trying so desperately to follow that road as well. So I've, been very, very lucky.
My guess is that it's not entirely luck, but I ask a particular question.
Okay.
And it is, do you remember, could you tell me, the very first moment in your life when you found yourself drawn to music or to theater or to sound or to...
Well, I come from a family of musicians, of course, and I, and so I was kind of, I had one brother that was very sports oriented, and he was the hunter and fisher.
The jock.
Yes. And then there was me. And my aunt, my mother's sister, was my piano teacher. So, I always enjoyed music. But I think that when I think about what I do now, and I often think about this one particular moment, because I'm a conductor, mm-hmm. And I've always loved conducting. I've found a very kind of circuitous path to get to this, but I always remember this one moment. I was in band. I was a freshman in band, and we were playing, of all things, a concert arrangement of Begin the Beguine. And the band director just said, we were going to do it for a concert, and he said, who would like to conduct Begin the Beguine for concert? And I remember just sitting in my seat with my alto saxophone. I said, I do. And that was the beginning. And I remember conducting, and I didn't know what this, and of course that began my love of Cole Porter and, you know, just music that kind of spoke to me. I wasn't quite sure why. But, you know, I always loved musicals and, you know.
Well, okay, wait a second. So now you have mentioned two instruments. You had piano, yeah, and you had alto sax.
Right, and then when I went to college...
Oh, no, wait. Back up. When did you start to learn the piano? How old were you?
I was about fourth grade, so I'm not quite sure what that is. Or like 9, 10.
And was that your idea, did you say? Or was that just in the...
It was kind of like, okay, take piano lessons. You're not very good at baseball. Sorry.
No, is that really true?
Yep.
Is that really true? Is your brother older than you?
Yeah.
So he was already the jock guy?
Yeah.
And you...
And the thing was we all took piano from my aunt. And
including the jock.
Oh, yeah. They all took piano and didn't do very well. And so my aunt didn't want to teach me because all the rest of them, you know, kind of went by the wayside. But I guess I was the one that kind of took to it. And so...
So I understand that this was a sort of family imperative. Everybody
yeah.
takes piano lessons.
Sure.
Was, yeah, right. I had the same family. and it's funny. Were you the last?
Mm-hmm.
I see. And by that time, your aunt was saying, please, no more,
yes.
right? Enough, right?
Yes.
And then, were you drawn to it at
oh, yeah.
all? Or well, was it just, okay, fine, I had to do it?
No, because it was, you know... I guess I had a good instinct for it. I had good musical instincts. And, you know, it was something that I felt like I did well. And I wasn't the most disciplined of piano students, but there were things that I think I instinctively knew or I had an instinct for that in spite of my, you know, not... being
working
as a
that
diligent
hard.
Practice. Now, the strange thing is that today I'm a practicer. You know, I will spend hours and hours in a day, you know, especially if I'm prepping a score or, you know, trying to learn, learning a score. You know, I have to say, for all the hours that I didn't practice when I was a child, I've made up for it, you know, as an adult. You know?
Okay, so, all right, so we have you in the fourth grade at the beginning of
yeah.
your attachment, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then at some point you decide you need to study the alto sax?
Well, that was my, I was in the band.
So you...
I was in the band.
I know, but...
Well, that was suggested to me.
It was again.
So
you want to be in the band, right? Yeah, right. Okay,
play,
fine.
Play the alto.
So you play in the alto sax, and you like it. You don't
yeah,
like
well,
it.
I
you like
it,
right? And you
yeah.
like playing in the band.
And I loved playing in the band. Again, it was another, you know, it was another avenue of
using
of
the music,
music
right?
Of music,
right, right, right. And by now, the family sees that this is
yeah,
this is your
it.
Thing.
Yeah,
right?
I became the music kid, you
yeah.
know, and I played the organ at church. I was the church organist.
Okay,
you know.
So already you're making a life with this music, right?
Yes.
And then this is so funny. I mean, the conductor says, "Who wants to conduct it?" I've never heard that.
And of all things, Begin the Begin.
Yes.
Which there was just, you know, it's truly one of the great songs. And, of course, put into the hands of a ninth grader with a band, you know, like your built-in orchestra. And I just got up there and I conducted it.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so we, you know, he worked with me on how to conduct
it. He did?
It. Oh, yeah. How to conduct the piece. And I learned, you know, just some rudimentary things about conducting. And...
Yeah.
I, you know, in all of the things that I've done over the years, when I look at myself as a conductor, I feel like it becomes kind of the synthesis of all of my experiences, because
yes.
all of my experiences as a pianist, a musician, an instrumentalist musician, and an actor, a singer, a dancer, a performer.
Oh, well, we have yet to get
there.
No,
I know, but all of that, I feel like when I do this, all of that then becomes an extension of...
You draw on all of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is all that you are sort of synthesized into this thing.
Yeah, as Oscar Hammerstein would say, it's all the things you are. But I'm bumped, Mr. Kern. Oscar
Hammerstein. Thank you very much. Okay. Very, very nice. But yes. And again, this is not something I've ever heard. And I think it's really an interesting way to look at conducting. You're not saying, I really got off on showing these people what to do, when to do it.
Right.
No. That's, being in charge.
Well, I think that, I wouldn't, when I look at myself as a conductor, it's like a lot of times people say, well, so, you're a pianist, do you play, classical rep? And I don't really have those kinds of chops, and I'll always refer to myself as a show tune hack, but I feel like every bit of spiritual connection to what a composer has written for the theater, my knowledge of acting, character, breath, all of those things, coupled with just an understanding of that type of music,
it all informs what you do.
Yeah. And so I don't feel like it's any less than, a conductor who is, conducts a symphony or something like that.
No, but it's very special.
Yeah.
It's very special because you bring the knowledge of what's going on stage.
Mm-hmm. In the way that I approach not only teaching the music, but in the way that I... Like when I'm in an orchestra rehearsal, I have to talk about character. I have to talk about how an orchestra, and particularly in this show too, how the orchestration really reflects so much of what the characters are experiencing.
Yeah, it's not separate from, it's integral too.
It's not like, okay, you learn the music and you plug it in.
Right,
you just can't do that.
Well, you can't do that. Right. Okay. All right. So we have this pivotal moment, this seminal experience.
Begin the beginning.
Where you begin, essentially.
Exactly.
Yeah, right. It's marvelous. And then you do you know that this is something you want to do? Do you know
this
is a job?
It kind of I did a lot of, I thought I'd be a band director. And so when I went to college, I was a bassoonist.
Of course you were.
Yeah, of course. I was a bassoon, and I loved the bassoon. But again, there was a certain kind of a discipline, then you had to learn, and I was instrumental major, so I had to, learn flute, you had to learn all of the instruments, because you have to know how to teach them. I was ADD at that time, because I was just I was so focused on the theater that, it wasn't like a singer who can kind of sing and be in productions, because a musician, the bassoonist, my bassoon teacher just said, you're going to have to make a choice. And actually what the choice ended up being was I had my wisdom teeth taken out and it messed up my embouchure for playing the bassoon and playing these other instruments.
The universe said,
we're going to show you. And so I'm like, my mouth just is not playing anymore. And so I changed majors and became a theater major and started studying, acting and being in productions. But at the same time, I was still playing the piano a lot. I wasn't in that department anymore, but I still had my hand over there. I had taken all my conducting classes, I'd taken all my theory classes and stuff like that. So that, that chapter, that element or that chapter had been kind of completed as far as that. Now, if I had my druthers now, I would love to go back and complete, that music degree, you know.
Really?
You know, just because it, I don't know, they're just, there are things about just a little bit more kind of the nomenclature and the vocabulary, you know, because there are times when, you know, like I'm working with real musicians or, you know, more classical musicians, and they'll refer to a term on the page, and I'll go,
okay.
Yeah. sure. Do that. yeah. Mm-hmm, sure.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's...
No, I understand.
That's, you know...
Yes, right. They have something you don't have, but you have something they don't have.
Well, thank you.
And that's the trade-off, isn't it?
You know, but I think that's a good point. I mean, I just think that the way I've had a very fortunate, but I think a different kind of path to get to where I am, whereas it's not reflective of, you know, I didn't major in conducting, I didn't major in this, I didn't, you know, it's just all of a sudden I had an interest in it, and all of a sudden I was...
Able,
and I was, and the experience came, or the opportunity came.
Yeah, I want to hear about that. But I do want to say that, ironically, perhaps, synchronistically, I don't know, you know, what you did get was a background that makes you particularly able to work in theater.
Well, it was a good jumping point. I mean, it. You know what? when I think about it, thank you for kind of helping me put it in, you know, into words. One thing sort of would whet my appetite for this and for that and for that, and you know, in again, how a person sort of amasses experience to kind of mold themselves. You know, that's probably a very functional way of kind of developing, you know.
Organic.
Yeah, I guess that's a good word. And Robert Jarrow loves that word, organic. I've learned so much from, again, learned so much from him. You know, so as I became more of an actor and more of a singer, and not necessarily a great actor, or, you know, I was sort of a very serviceable one, and I went to the Williamstown Theater Festival when I was in college, and that was sort of a very eye-opening experience, because it was working with people on a, you know, and it was sort of the golden days of the Williamstown Theater Festival.
So were you an actor?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so I, you know, I, all of the things that I kind of gravitated to, like, you know, voice and speech, and of course I, you know, loved musical theater, but, you know, it kind of forced me to, you know, look at some more serious acting technique. And again, it's not so much that I was good at Greek drama, or, I mean, there were certain kinds of comedic things that I was really quite good at. Funny. that's what the reviews told me. it's funny. But when I got to Williamstown, you know, and those were in the days when, and of course, at the Williamstown Theater Festival, you know, you've got all these great actors, you know, Blythe Danner, Ed Herman, Chris Walken, just Diane Wiest, Joanne Woodward, all these really wonderful actors doing Chekhov and a lot of Tennessee Williams, Arthur Miller, these wonderful plays, and they do a cabaret there. That's one of the things besides the main stage. And that's what I was fascinated with, because they would do, you know, you'd have all of these, you know, these big stars and people, and at night after the show, their music department would put together these amazing cabarets, and it was just electric. I mean, just, you know, and the people singing, and just all sorts of, and so I kind of, you know, wormed my way into that department, and they found me very useful as a young, you know, kind of
eager.
And in fact, when I was there that summer, I and again, seminal moments, I remember seeing their one of those cabarets that night and walking around the campus late at night, just sort of in this daze of, you know, kind of inspiration. And I said to myself, I'm going to put one together myself. And I went to a piano and started writing arrangements of Let's Do It, and I decided I was going to do a Cole Porter cabaret with a group of apprentices, and we worked on it all summer long, and one night we did it, and like three years later I was on staff there. You know, I had, and I continued my kind of connections with the music department there, and became, you know, in fact, the head of the music department, Michael O'Flaherty, who's been a mentor of mine, who I met in 1981, is the resident conductor at Goodspeed. And so, I mean, where I've been working. And so Michael and I have been working together, and I would say in a period since 1981 to 2013, there's probably been maybe 10 years, maybe a 10-year, like in summers, where I haven't worked with him. So he and I have just the most incredibly long
relationship,
professional and personal relationship. I mean, we've been the greatest of friends. And but it, again, that was, you know, one of those moments, you know, yes, where I...
Yeah, you know, knew them when they happened.
Oh, gosh.
That's,
you know,
right?
It's funny. It's that. And then, because Nikos Sakharopoulos, he taught at Yale, and he would bring a lot of the young actors from Yale, and he also taught at the school Circle in the Square in New York. And I don't know why, I decided I'm going to Circle in the Square. And so I prepped an audition for Circle, and I think the following year when I graduated, I auditioned for Circle in the Square, and I got accepted. And as an actor. And what I appreciated, you know, this little boy from the bayous, you know, in Louisiana, I had gotten like a couple of the directors, like Austin Pendleton, to write a letter of recommendation, because I was in a play that he had directed. He had just directed The Little Foxes with Elizabeth Taylor. Mm-hmm. And so
it was a very big deal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so he was, you know, and he's a kind of one of the regular directors, and he would sing in the cabaret at Williamstown. So he cast me in a little part in this Gorky play, Summer Folk. And there I was, you know, just in these rehearsals and being directed by Austin. It was just, and I remember when Little Foxes was on tour, they came to New Orleans, and I had contacted Austin. So he said, well, wait for me at the stage door. And of course, there's a mob, and I have all my friends, and Austin kind of comes to the door and goes, wait. Of course, crowd opens. I felt like Moses. And so, you know, he introduced me to Elizabeth Taylor and Maureen Stapleton and all that gang. So it was, you know, for a kid, you know, from LSU, that was really wonderful. So, I mean, by these little inroads,
I don't think they're so little. And I think that the sense I'm getting is that you had a very strong intuition about where you needed to be. It's what I said a little bit earlier about when the moments happened, you knew and you said yes.
Well, I'm as I look back on it now, I say, but I think I probably had no idea what I was doing.
Well, you didn't have any conscious idea.
No,
that's not what
I mean.
That's
just sort of like, oh, sure, okay. I'll do my own cabaret. Oh, and you know what was so funny? When they came in, I went into a room, it was in their music department, and the geek that I am, what did I have with me? The score to Showboat. And I'm sitting there playing, you know, I'm playing the overture to Showboat, and someone comes in and goes, do you play the piano? And I went, yeah. And he said, play some more for me. And I'm sitting there playing, you know, I'm playing the opening to Showboat, you know. And so it kind of like evolved from that.
Well, again.
Showboat.
Yes,
go
right.
Figure.
Go figure. Exactly. But probably we should talk about Showboat.
Yeah.
You and Rob did it at Goodspeed.
Yes.
right? And, well, like, apparently you found Showboat as a very young man. And what was it about Showboat that made you...
Well, I'm Southern. You know, I remember seeing it when I was pretty young. But it was more this... I kind of got... I found my way into loving it more, first of all, by the score itself.
It's,
you know,
beautiful.
Before I kind of, really started studying the book and all the other stuff, but just something about that score, you know, even very young, that it kind of covered all the bases in some ways. Just a sort of a, you know, just kind of an emotional, the beauty of the score. I mean, it's very, you know, and when it's more in its kind of like operetta format, which is the way I kind of knew it, there was just something so gallant about it, and I loved the color of the sound of things. There's that big World's Fair section, and I just would sit there listening to recordings of it and just imagine what it was like, you know. And
it's amazing that you wound up doing it.
Yeah, and many times. I've directed it a few times, too, myself.
Really?
Oh, yeah, yeah. But it's always kind of, you know, anyone will ask me, what's your favorite musical? And I don't know why, but it's always, I always come out of principle, I think. It's always been Showboat. And I have many musicals that I you know, really love for different reasons. But for some reason... I'm always sticking by, you know, that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. Showboat has always been the piece that I you know, has the biggest piece of my heart.
I think. So when you say that, what makes me wonder is this Showboat, the one that you guys created, mm-hmm, for Goodspeed and that you're doing here at the Oslo. And by the way, it's the first time I've seen the show, so for me, it's an extraordinary experience. But I know from other people who have seen earlier versions and from what you're saying that this is very different. And do you mind?
Well, I remember, and it's so funny because, you know, even the people at Goodspeed know, you know, they kind of warned me when I, you know, we started rehearsals, you know, you're not going to like this.
I was just going to say, this isn't
like,
your father's Showboat, right?
And Rob, you know, Rob would quite often in rehearsals, when he would talk about a change or something, he would always go, and Wade's really not going to like this. And the point is that, you know, Showboat is a hard piece to do. And the fact that, you know, that Rob had the courage to make it live and make it accessible in another way, because his vision has so much integrity and he is so committed to it. I mean, of course I'm on board with it.
Yeah,
you know?
It is that you have admiration for the reason that he's done it.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's not like, and I don't think it's, oh, let's create a small Showboat. That's helpful because it will make it a much more accessible to other performing venues. But Rob loves the story, and he had great respect for the music. He made some musical changes it's kind of good that he's not like this musical, you know, that everything is, you know, sacred, because he was, you know, he was going to say, all right, this is a little superfluous for telling the story that we're telling, you know, and I might make a point to him about, well, could we do this? He goes, but that's not the story we're telling.
Yeah.
And luckily, the Rodgers and Hammerstein estate, you know, who licenses Showboat, he has such a wonderful relationship with them, and, you know, with Alice Hammerstein and with Julie Gilbert, who was the niece of Edna Ferber, they knew that this jewel was in good hands.
Yeah.
And because at Goodspeed, you know, we there's such a reverence. I mean, that's their mission, basically.
Yeah, right.
That's part of their mission is.
What I keep thinking is that it wasn't cavalier on his part.
Oh no, by no means.
Right, and so one can have admiration for that motivation, even if one isn't always.
And the thing is that a lot of the changes that he made, you know, he drew from existing material. You know, that Rob is so thorough in his research. He'll listen to every recording.
So
he'll read every script. He'll see every movie. And, you know, and so he...
So he was true to it.
Oh, gosh, yes. Oh, my gosh, yes. So, whereas, you know, hopefully I'll have the experience of doing
your own.
The Urtex showboat at some point. But I still, you know,
Yeah, I know.
My heart is full of gratitude and just like, I write to my friends in Boston, and go, you know, regularly going,
wow.
Showboat. It never ceases to amaze me.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see it. I'm sorry this is video because this isn't video because you could see it when he talks about it.
Oh,
it's
gosh.
It's lovely. No. I'm sure the thing that makes people want to work with you is that you inhabit it. You know?
Well, it's, you know, again, it's I'm one of the other things that I've been really fortunate with, you know, as my career has evolved, I've had the opportunity of working with people whose passion for telling stories and developing a vocabulary of how to tap into characters and direct well and look at a script and how to bring a script to life, how to break it down, how to make, you know, as Rob would say, make it live, you know.
Who are serious.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And as a result of that, the way I look at a musical, I have to have this
mm-hmm.
with every piece that I do.
Yeah.
I've been a little lucky in the last, for a while, that I've done shows that are based on great plays, and a good speed is like this. We did Carousel a couple years ago, Rob directed, which is, of course, based on Lilium, the Molnar play. And then last year we did Hello, Dolly, which is based on, of course, the Matchmaker. And, of course, I am the resident, you know, no, I don't want to say dramaturg because but I'm known up at Goodspeed. There's like a circuit of places where I go and I lecture. And generally what I like to do is, especially if I'm working on a play that's a musical that's based on a play, focus on how the play was then, you know, the play was obviously successful,
mm-hmm.
said something important,
right.
That a group of creators, like Jerry Herman and Gower Champion and David Merrick, decided we're going to take The Matchmaker and we're going to turn it into a musical. And how they took that play and changed the story to make it the story of a woman's triumph from watching everyone having experiences that she is the one, she would make everyone have experiences because she put her hand in everything. And it got to the place where she said, everyone else is having a life, it's time for me.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we think of Hello, Dolly, but when I started studying what they did to create this piece about a woman who triumphs and just sort of comes back to life, I thought, this is really an inspiring story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, and, you know, in each one of these, you know, and so I think that one of the things about Showboat, just bringing it back to that, reading, Ferber's book, and I've read so many different things about, it's just kind of interesting, because we sort of impose a lot of things on Ms. Ferber's book that, I mean, Edna Ferber was kind of like, you know, she wrote about the American experience, you know, and all of her books kind of take place in different parts of the country. Of course, Giants in Texas, Showboats about this, you know, this aspect of theater history. What is it? Ice Palace takes place, of course, in Alaska. Come and Get It up in the, you know, in the logging area. So all of her stories kind of take place in different parts of the country. But what we find in Showboat is that she wasn't out to write Uncle Tom's Cabin.
No.
She wasn't out to write...
She wasn't, you know, making a statement.
No, at whatsoever. And as I read about how she did her research, which is, you know, very thorough for, you know, someone writing a book, you know, she went and spent time on it, and she didn't know anything about Showboats, and this was the kind of fun story. She was doing a play of hers in a New London, Connecticut, which is about 20 miles from Goodspeed, and it was opening night, and it was a disaster. There were bats flying in, and it was just something. And the producer said, well, it couldn't get any worse. If it gets any worse, we'll just all buy a showboat and go traveling up and down the river doing plays. And she said, Showboat? What is that? And she'd never heard of it.
Oh, my God.
And so he began to tell her about what the showboats were. Well, it immediately kind of whet her appetite for a topic. And so by 1925, 26, there were very few of them left because, you know, because of the advent of movies and things like that. But there were still a couple that were on the river, and she found one in Chesapeake Bay up in that area. And so she made contact with the captain of the boat and went and spent a few days with him, and, you know, she worked, you know, she observed the crew, and he, you know, just the troupe of actors, how it operated, and, you know, he would sit down and just, you know, tell her stories of the showboat, and, you know, just so great to read, you know, she just would write, you know, and she was always so afraid to take her pen off the page, because she was afraid that she was going to miss something. And so, she, you know, how she wrote the story, and of course, you know, you know, kind of racial, the relationship of the races at that time, and, you know, how the kind of class system on the boat, you know, how, there was just that sort of relationship that was still kind of in the South post-Civil War. You know, the conditions were not that great. And interestingly enough, the whole story, the miscegenation storyline, is based on an actual...
Really?
Is based on an actual event. The captain told her that he was a musician for a carnival. And the owner of the carnival was having a relationship with a woman of mixed race, and he would put makeup on her, and she would ballyhoo the show. And so, but they had
he would
this
put makeup on her,
on
that
her
was
to kind of make her to pass for white. And so she would, you know, she was you know, just kind of a member of the carnival, and there was a drummer in the band who was very jealous of,
yeah.
And so the drummer, I mean, he fired him. And so the drummer went exactly like the show.
Really?
Went to the sheriff and told him. And so the sheriff arrested both of them. And the actual event of him cutting her, sucking her blood so that he would have Negro blood in him. And so when they went to court, they had to go to trial for it. It was really, you know, the way she describes it. You know, basically, he was a pariah. They were found guilty. You know, I guess they were fired from the carnival or
right.
Whatever, and went to you know, live on their own somewhere. And in fact, then she left him. The woman left him and married married another black man. So the whole story
wow.
kind of, I know, has. It's all kind of based on on a real, you know, real, real tale. And when Ferber was the I forget what the name of that town, Pamlico, it was on Pamlico, the Pamlico River. She stayed in like a little, an inn there. And there was a, you know, she like went to the church and everything. And she uses a lot of the details about that little town and this nasty little rooming house and the church and all of that. And some of the characters in town kind of crept into her story. And I you know, was reading that when the book finally came out,
People
were not happy with.
No, they recognized themselves.
Yes, what Miss Ferber had done. but what? So just getting back, I mean, to Edna Ferber's story, she writes so beautifully. I mean, those passages. I wish I had brought them with me about the river. I mean, you can see the in her writing how Kern and Hammerstein just kind of lifted, I don't want to say lifted, but were so inspired by her descriptions of the world and what these characters were happening. I mean, there are some scenes in the play, in the book, that Hammerstein used a lot, some of the actual, you know, dialogue in the play. But it's so easy to see where Old Man River came from. It's so easy to see where Can't Help Loving That Man came from. It was so easy to see where Life Upon the Wicked Stage came from. I mean, it's not like in The Matchmaker where, you know, Jerry Herman just kind of,
right.
You know, she says, I put my hand in it, and he says it all, and then she says before the parade passes. I mean, they kind of latched into the play, exactly. Mm-hmm. But it's so, her writing is really evocative.
Hold on a second. To wrap up, because we have to, I ask one other question, which hopefully you will answer for me in not too long.
Okay, I'm sorry. I you can see, I could.
I know, and I'm sorry not to be able to go on.
No.
Shh. The other question I ask is, having given so much of a life to this work, is there anything you would say about it?
Well, I feel like it's important. You know, I just feel like the work that we do as, you know, and as for my art, from what I do, I feel like there's an importance about it, you know, and I find it in my teaching, I find it in what I do, is that it becomes, it's sort of a contribution to making society better. And it's not so much that I'm out to entertain. It has nothing to do with that. I mean, it has something to do with that. But it's also that I'm an artist. You know, doctors, you know, heal cancer. These people do that. This is what I do, and I do it to the best of my ability to somehow make society better, to use my art in a very honest, committed sort of way. And I do that in my teaching. I try to, you know, tell my students that what you're doing is important because you're nurturing your a God-given ability to somehow through your art, through your talent, make the world better. And you know, more than doing Showboat, more than doing, you know, creating music, I feel like that's sort of my, I don't know, my vocation in life is to be, you know, to be, use everything in my life to make sure that downbeat is a result of, you know, my life experiences, and that's my responsibility. I feel like that's my responsibility. It's my responsibility. Wade Russo's responsibility in his life now and hopefully till the end of it.
That's a great place to stop. Thank you so much, Wade.
That's Wade Russo's responsibility now and hopefully for all of my life. Now, when you can say that, then you know that you are being who you are, that you are using all you have. And as I said earlier in the show, I hope that when you listen to this, when you listen to the passion, to the commitment, to the enchantment that Wade brings to his work, to his life, that you're asking yourself, is there something that would make me feel like this? Like I was where I was supposed to be and living out the responsibility of my life? Well, if that happened to you and you want to talk about it, then go up on my website, thelinshow.com, and let me know and we can talk about it. But of course, as I hinted at the beginning, this was a very long interview and there's not much left of this show, and I do want to play me reading Sharon Leslie's glorious review of Showboat, because if you're close to Sarasota, you want to run right out and see this show. It is really not to be missed. So here is Sharon's review.
Break out the champagne. If you have seen Showboat and heard the music numerous times before, you will be delightfully surprised by this fresh and sparkling chamber production at the Oslo Repertory Theater. Before I continue, I must tell you that I have been in the show, sung much of the music, and heard Old Man River, well, seems like thousands of times. And yes, dare I say it, I was slightly dreading sitting through yet another tired production of singers trying to outdo one another. However, give a cheer and drink a toast. You can't help loving how director Rob Ruggiero has reimagined the book, pacing, and approach to the music. How the orchestra brings it to life, how the dancing bubbles over and sparks the show, how the performers are so believable, and how exquisite the look is on stage. This gorgeous show is involving and human. Showboat is a great classic, not just because of the popularity of the music, or because it was groundbreaking in the history of musical theater, but because the story still speaks to us today. We all have families and a support group of friends and neighbors. A showbiz family is a particularly close-knit group of individuals, sometimes real families, sometimes not, who form bonds while working together. They travel together, they eat together, they dress together in the same dressing rooms. In order to do a good job each night, a high amount of trust in each other must be employed. On the Cotton Blossom Showboat is that kind of extended family, made up of whites and African Americans. Their bonds are strong despite the years that pass. All the voices in the show are outstanding, but even better, the interpretations reflect what is going on with the characters. Make-believe reflects the whole theater atmosphere as Magnolia and Ravenel play out their act of falling in love, with the dramatic irony that it is actually happening. Can't Help Loving That Man becomes an upbeat Negro spiritual. Old Man River is about faith through hardship, and You Are Love, a declaration of romantic attachment. Ben Davis makes a dashing Gaylord Ravenel. His baritone is rich and expressive. As Magnolia, Marissa McGowan enchants us with her appealing soprano as she grows from an innocent child to a supportive wife to a single mom with a career as a leading lady. Daniela Dalli uses her seductive mezzo to display the sexuality and vulnerability of Julie. She'll bring tears to your eyes as she's singing of her longings in Bill. Old Man River is the great anthem of the oppressed working man. Michael James Leslie makes the song personal with his lush voice. It is a treat to watch him perform Joe with humor and pathos. E. Faye Butler brings comic relief with her portrayal of Queenie, and as all clowns must cry on the inside, her singing of Misery's Coming Around shows a world-weary life experience. The glue that holds this showboat together is found in Joel Blum's performance as Captain Andy Hawks. As he invites us into the show, he's actually inviting us into their lives. While his wife, Parthy May, it seems to ride roughshod over him, it is actually Captain Andy who displays an unwavering love for his daughter, his wife, and for all his performers. He even continues to love Ravenel as a son despite the gambling addiction. Blum brings warmth and a core of steel in his love for those that are close to him. Noah Racy's choreography adds visual delight, verve, and welcome touches of humanity to the musical sequences. Most of all, I am a fan of good direction in theatrical productions, and with this one, you will get the cream of the crop. It shows in every moment being thought out and given purpose, with little touches like how a handkerchief is used, to watching how the characters interact, to how a show or scene is defined. Ruggiero has brought a touching vision of these characters' lives and the passing of time in which they lived. So clink your crystal goblets. This production of Showboat is one not to be missed. Okay, so between listening to Wade talk about it and listening to Sharon's review, and if you were listening a couple of weeks ago and heard my interview with Rob Ruggiero, the director, I know you want to see this production. And it is still running, so run right out, fly right over. Come on down. Okay, so as always, I hope you got something that you can use from this show. Something that intrigued you, something that inspired you, something that you didn't know that you know now, that you're glad you know. Something that will bring you back. Because I will be here next week, same time, same station. And as always, I hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. Going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So